question. What does this mean? Pedrus asked. The four wizards stood, or sat, in silence, staring at the fireplace for inspiration.
I admit, this is not my area of expertise, Pedrus said, after several minutes.
Nor mine, added Shummus.
The mysteries of...
Oh!
Wing took in a sharp breath. She put a hand across her face. Her knees wobbled, and she slumped into a chair. Pedrus was on his feet in a flash.
Wing, are you well?
Deep concern showed on his face. He knelt at her feet and held her hands in his own.
Yes, yes, thank you.
She held his hands, perhaps a moment too long, then pulled away gently.
Wild cards,
she told Pedrus.
It was his turn to gasp in surprise.
Could it be?
It makes sense, no?
Wing responded.
Would the two of you mind explaining to the rest of us?
Shoma said, mildly irritated. A cookie would have improved his mood.
Wing smiled. I was recalling something I have not thought about for many years, not since I was a little girl, learning the craft of magic in a school high up in the mountains. There were cards there, cards used to tell fortunes, to foresee the future. These cards were not used, not even in training. They were a sort of museum, a dusty old library of wizardry. I remember asking a very old wizard about this deck of cards, and he showed them to me, and told me such cards had not been used by wizards for many, many centuries, since the spell to create your picture cards was created.
She pointed to Muazzo's deck of blank cards.
Before such picture-revealing cards were developed, wizards used a different type of cards.
Yes,
Muazzo answered slowly, ransacking the depths of his memory. He was a student of wizardry, in addition to being a master of the arcane subject.
The art was very limited back then. A deck of cards had various hand-painted images. A wizard would shuffle the cards and deal them one by one. The spirits were thought to have influence on which cards came to the top, to indicate the person's fortune.
I've seen such cards. I don't remember where, Shoma said, half lost in thought.
There was a card with a skeleton, indicating death. A card with a sword, indicating battle, or fighting, or danger. It was very crude,
he observed, with a rather disparaging smile, wondering how wizards of that age managed to accomplish anything with their crude magics.
Skeletons, yes, Wing agreed, and swords, also lovers, and flowers, the sun and the moon. Among those in the deck was a special card, a card sometimes called the Joker, or the Trickster, a card that could represent any card, a card that presented any possibility and all possibilities at once. A wild card.
A wild card.
Muazzo pondered the idea.
I do seem to recall hearing such in my studies of ancient magic. If a person drew a wild card, it was supposed to mean that person had no fate. That even the spirits did not know his or her future. That the person was entirely in control of their own destiny. That their future was not written.
But drawing such a card would be rare, exceedingly rare.
He was silent a moment.
Do we now have two wild cards?
Is it possible?
Is what possible?
Shomus almost shouted.
Consider, Shomus,
Pedrus said.
Four people, one a powerful wizard, he nodded to Madame Chu, three are servant boys, who all have the same fortune, identical fortunes. A fortune which says
The future will be largely determined by a lightning bolt and a crown, by a wizard and a queen. Now, consider two other people, one a future wizard, one a future queen. The cards for their futures are not fixed. The cards display images of every possible future. Their futures are not fixed in any way, for they control their own fates.
And ours,
Muazza added in a near whisper. Somehow, they control our fates.
A boy and a girl? Shelmus scoffed.
He rose from the chair to poke at the fire, pushing a log into a pile of glowing coals.
I mean no offense, Muazzo, but Corrin is merely a boy, and Arianna a girl. They may very well become immensely powerful some day, but right now, Corrin is mucking out stalls in the stables, and Arianna can't do anything without asking permission from her mother. A mother who says no to almost everything. Cecil, you are telling me these two children control my fate?
No, Shomas. Muazzo pointed to the cards. That is what the spirits tell us. The spirits see this world as it truly is. Not this illusion. He tapped the wooden table with a finger. That we perceive as real.
You do control your own fate. What the spirits are telling us is that whatever you do, what we all do, ultimately does not matter. Corrin and Arianna will decide the fate of this world. We only matter in how we affect them.
Shomas turned to Pedras in frustration.
You believe this nonsense?
Pedras nodded gravely.
I do.
I do also, Wing added.
She stood and began to pace in front of the fire.
More importantly, our enemy will. Our enemy has been blind as we were to the future. Until a dozen years ago, when our ability to foresee the future began to fade, our enemy was content to bide its time, to chip away at our defenses, to be patient. For the enemy saw the same inevitable future we saw. We would be defeated. The barriers between this world and the underworld would be sundered, and demons would consume us. The demon is unspeakably ancient. It can wait. Time is nothing to it.
She took a breath and looked up into the faces of her fellow wizards.
When the future became unclear, the demon grew afraid for the first time, for its victory was no longer certain, and it didn't know why. It could no longer wait, so it has been on the attack for a decade. King Adric died not because the enemy is bold and confident, but because the enemy is fearful. Now we see our fates are determined by a wizard and a queen. Our enemy will see the same, if it has not already.
Pedras nodded, his face grim.
Cecil, what has happened? Before the fortune cards were blank. Now they clearly show the images of lightning bolt and crown. What has changed?
Pedras expected Lord Muazzo to ponder that question a while before answering, perhaps take a sip of wine while he considered the matter.
Instead, he answered right away.
Because their spirits have now seen the futures of Arianna and Corrin.
No one has ever cast Arianna's fortune before today? Wing asked, surprised.
Pedras shrugged.
Her mother has always forbidden it. That is why we needed to manipulate Arianna into requesting Cecil into casting her fortune, without her mother knowing about it. Cecil, I didn't understand your answer.
Pedras exchanged a puzzled look with Shomas.
This is not my area of expertise, he admitted.
Their spirits could not tell anyone's fortune before, because the spirits did not know anyone's future. We had not asked the right questions.
Muazzo attempted to explain.
The spirits only look into the future when we ask them to. The future of this world is of no interest to them otherwise. Then we asked the spirits to look into Corin and then Ariana's futures. And the spirits now know that everyone's fate is tied to Ariana and Corin.
The enemy knows this also?
Shomus asked with great alarm.
No, no. The enemy will only see what we have seen. A lightning bolt and a crown. The enemy cannot cast the fortunes of Ariana and Corin without their blood.
I expect the enemy will assume the wizard is you, Pedrus, and that the crown belongs to Carlana. There is no reason for the enemy to think of a young servant boy and a girl who has not yet come of age.
Pedrus, you and Carlana will be in great danger,
Wing said, her voice half-choked with concern.
I see no change there, Pedrus said. The enemy has long sought my death, and the regent is as securely protected as she can be. For Corin and Ariana, their apparent unimportance is their best defense for now. No, I don't see that anything has changed there, except that I expect our enemy to grow more desperate to strike at us, to end this war soon, by force, before the future escapes its grasp. Now, Lord Moiseau, there is one final card to cast. You know the card I speak of?
Moiseau's hands trembled when he reached for the deck of cards.
Yes, he spoke in a harsh whisper. Do you think this is wise, Pedrus?
If I ask this question of the spirits, we will know, and the spirits will know.
And the enemy will know also, for the enemy will ask the spirits the same question.
Cecil, we must know. We have waited so long. We must know if this is the path forward, if this is our fate, our fortune, if the destiny of the world rests in the hands of two people so young, so unready.
Moiseau placed the two wild cards on the table, closed his eyes, muttered an incantation, and selected a card from the middle of the deck. His fingers were so unsteady he almost dropped the card on the floor. In the tense silence, the sound of the card hitting the table made Shomus jump. Moiseau took in a sharp breath. Pedrus bent over the table to look at the card, and he, too, gasped.
Ascendant! Ascendant!
The card displayed a raging fire reaching to the heavens.
Their power is ascendant.
They are so young, Madame Chu said in a whisper. We must protect them until they can protect themselves.
There was a sound of feet pounding on the stairs, and the wizards became silent as Corin poked his head in the doorway. He had been walking back from visiting Ariana when he saw Cully, who told him about the fortune-telling, and showed Corin the shiny silver coin he'd been paid.
Sirs, madam, can I do anything for you?
For some reason, Corin felt guilty to be wearing the fine clothes he used for visiting the palace when he was supposed to be serving the wizards. He glanced around the room in dismay to see how cluttered it was. It had been clean that very morning. He'd gotten out of bed early to scrub that very room until the floor shined, and now every flat surface was piled high with books, scrolls, empty cups and dishes, glasses, jars and crocks of roots, herbs and potions. He didn't need a magical card to foresee his immediate future. He would be up late, and getting up early to clean again.
Corin, hello!
Pedrus said, with a quick, guilty look of his own, and averted his eyes to look at the fireplace.
Uh-oh, Corin thought. What have they been up to while I was gone?
Corin, come in, boy,
Shomus called out, trying to suppress his grumpiness. He took a swig of beer from his mug, beer that had grown warm and flat, and so Shomus made a sour face. In his fine clothes,
clothes that were at odds with his current station in life as a servant boy, Corrin looked to be play-acting. Shomas found it difficult to believe this good-natured, still fairly ignorant, innocent, and clueless boy could somehow determine the fate of the entire world.
"Did you, have fun with the princess?"
A sharp look from Pedras and the sudden redness of Corrin's cheeks made Shomas hastily add,
"Moiso says the two of you were looking at maps of the eastern border."
"Oh, yes, sir. Her mother has been wishing the princess..."
He avoided calling her Ariana, as that would seem far too familiar. "To learn about the Indus Empire. Because their new ambassador is here, I suppose." Corrin noted that all four of the wizards appeared uncomfortable. He suspected they'd been talking about him. Eager to get away, he began picking up dirty dishes. The large tankard that held beer was almost empty, and the beer at the bottom smelled stale.
"Could I get you a fresh tankard of beer, sir?"
he asked Shomas, "and see if the kitchens have something to snack on, as it is hours before supper time. Sometimes the kitchens have hot rolls or salty pretzels."
"Oh!" Shomas clapped his hands. "Yes, more beer, please."
To Corrin's surprise, Moiso rose from his chair and added dishes to the pile in Corrin's arms.
"I would dearly love a fresh hot pretzel, and I think, as Shomas seems so fond of it, I would try some of this beer."
Corrin bowed as he backed out of the room, laden with dirty dishes. He could see that somehow he needed to convince the royal kitchens to bake pretzels, whether they liked it or not. Shomas left 3 days later, while Madame Chu and Lord Moiso stayed in the castle for another week, then reluctantly had to leave, before the coming winter snows trapped them away from their homes. Corrin was sorry to see them go, especially Lord Moiso. The tall, thin wizard had become positively friendly, insisting that Corrin put aside his chores to study books with him, learning about history and, to Corrin's surprise, wizardry. Moiso did not, of course, show Corrin how to cast spells or create magical potions. Instead, they talked about the nature of light and dark magic, the history of wizards, and the rules that all good wizards had to live by. That seemed to be very important. Moiso was very concerned that Corrin learn about the heavy responsibilities of wizards, although Corrin could not understand why a mere servant had to care about such things. Afternoons were spent in the cramped chamber Moiso used as a study, reading books or scrolls in front of a warm fireplace, with hot tea and plenty of snacks to eat. Corrin was sorry to see Moiso leave, for it meant Corrin went back to the drudgery of chores as the wizard's servant.
"Hey, Corrin, ain't seen much of you the past fortnight," Cully said as he sidled up next to Corrin in the royal kitchens,
trying to squeeze in near the ovens where it was warm. It was a raw, grey, nasty day outside, with rain, sleet, and freezing rain, thoroughly miserable weather to be out in. So Corrin and Cully, and many other servants, were taking any excuse not to be outside unless they had to. Corrin had fed and brushed Thunderbolt, but the great horse had stuck his nose outside the stables, sniffed the damp cold air, and walked back to his warm, dry stall. Having been warned about the coming weather by the wizard the previous day, Corrin had plenty of firewood in the tower, so they didn't need to go outside to keep the stoves hot.
"I've been busy,"
Corrin said with a yawn. He was sleepy, both from the work and from the combination of being outside on the walk back from the stables with wet clothes, and now being lulled toward sleep by the overwarm air in the kitchens.
"All those wizards kept me hopping." "What were they doing?"
Cully asked curiously.
"Talking and eating a lot, and making a mess. I don't know why the other three came here so late in the year. Lord Salva didn't tell me."
Corrin yawned again, He couldn't help it.
He went back to bed after breakfast this morning. The wizard, I mean. Said this weather wasn't fit for man nor beast.
Sounds like you need coffee to keep you awake, Cully observed, trying to keep from yawning himself.
Yawning was contagious, he thought.
Never tried it, Corin admitted. It smells good when I grind the beans. What does it taste like?
Cully shrugged.
It's bitter, if you drink it black. Put some cream in and sugar, and it's good.
You never tried it, but you brew it every morning for the wizard.
So?
So you never took a sip yourself?
Corin was surprised.
That's Lord Salva's coffee. He has the beans brought in from his homeland twice a year. It's expensive.
Yeah, but come on. You never took a little sip. The wizard wouldn't notice.
Corin wasn't sure about that.
Wizards had ways of knowing things, and that didn't matter.
Corin owed the roof over his head and the food in his belly to the wizard.
He shook his head.
That would be stealing.
Steal?
Cully stopped when he realized Corin wasn't joking. You don't work for a wizard, Cully. He could turn me into a frog if he thought I was stealing from him. This isn't the time of year to be without a roof over your head.
One especially dreary winter day, when the cold rain dripping down the grey stone walls of the tower had become such a commonplace sound that people only paid attention when it stopped for a blessed moment, Pedrus put down his spoon and pushed away the bowl with a sigh.
Is the food bad, Lord Salva? Corin asked.
The cooks in the royal kitchen said they were beginning to run out of fresh fruits and vegetables as the winter dragged on, and the food had been less tasty recently.
No, no, it's fine, I suppose. All this rain has me a bit out of sorts.
Pedrus looked out the window and shivered. The sky had been dropping a sloppy mix of snow and rain for the last 2 weeks, and everyone in the castle was heartily sick of it.
Some days, I very much miss my homeland.
It's warmer than here in the winter. Although, of course, that means that it can be uncomfortably hot in the summertime.
Pedrus picked up a crust of bread and chewed it slowly.
And food there is better. All the cooks here know is this.
Pedrus made a sour face as he dipped a crust of bread into the gravy, then pushed his plate aside.
Bland food of the north.
Can I get you anything else, sir?
No, no, Corin. I'm just an old man thinking wistfully about the past, and waiting for this dreary winter to end. It seems like this winter will never end. Like the war, I'm afraid.
Will the war end soon, sir?
What? This war has been going on for—
Pedrus looked at Corin sharply.
Come here. Sit down. We haven't talked about the war. Now is a good time. What do you know of our enemy?
Corin thought about the stories he'd heard, likely mostly lies and exaggerations. People told children stories about Isidore to scare them.
Let me guess, Pedro said with a dry humor. You heard that if you were bad, Draylock would come on his terrible dragon and take you away?
Yes, sir, something like that.
Lord Draylock is a wizard named Mertis. He is a younger son of Duke Greylock of Savan Province in Usador. Twin son. His brother was born a few minutes earlier, and so Mertis felt he had been cheated of his inheritance. Even though Mertis soon showed he had the power of a wizard, still he resented his brother, who had become Duke.
Mertis grew jealous of other wizards in the court of Isidore, and went away for many years. It was later learned he had been studying dark magic.
When he returned, he clouded the mind of the king, whispering of secret enemies. And under his spell, the king grew feeble and paranoid, and would not listen to the wizard's counsel. Mertis arranged to become the king's chancellor,
Then he became the real power in Isidore. He made plans to conquer other lands, but the Wizard's Council and several of the dukes had grown fearful of Mertis and rebelled. The war was terrible. Wizard against wizard, province against province, and brother against brother. For Mertis's own brother, by then the Duke of Greylock, had joined the rebellion.
Why didn't all the dukes rebel?
Because Mertis had cast spells on many of the dukes, so they were slaves to his will. But they didn't realize they were slaves. That is the cleverness of such an evil spell.
Pedrus spat out the words as if they made a sour taste in his mouth.
It makes the victims believe they are doing what they wanted in the first place. They actually believed Mertis was protecting the rightful king, and that Mertis's brother was conspiring against Isidore. In the battle, Mertis killed his elder brother, and declared himself Lord Draelock. After he captured Savan province, and subdued his brother's remaining army, he turned and struck at his enemies, who had seized the royal castle with the last of the wizard's council. They had hoped to restore the king to health and break the spell, but Mertis was too clever for them. When they tried to break the spell, the king died, and they lost all hope. Most of the wizards stayed behind to fight Mertis, while the rebel army retreated to the east beyond the border of Isidore, carrying the cornerstone with them. Those rebels founded Tarador, and continue their fight to this day. Mertis let them go, for he had much to do to consolidate his control, and fighting the Wizard's Council drained his strength for many years.
He defeated the Wizard's Council by himself?
Dark magic is more powerful than good magic.
No!
Pedrus almost shouted the answer. The power of dark magic was a subject that angered Pedrus.
No, quite the opposite, Corrin. Tell me, does it take more effort to plow a field, plant seeds, and raise a field of corn, or to burn that field?
Corrin thought for a moment. Sure, this must be a trick question. To burn a field takes no effort, he answered slowly. Once you get a fire started.
Corn plants won't burn much if they're green. They need to be—
Yes, yes.
My point is, it is so much easier to destroy than to build. Dark magic is used only to destroy. It cannot create anything. It lacks the strength to create, or to heal, or to build. Mertis didn't defeat the Wizard's Council by himself. He had an army behind him, and enough soldiers with swords, spears, and arrows can overwhelm any wizard. And Mertis didn't care how many soldiers' lives he wasted to destroy the Wizard's Council, while the other wizards wanted as little bloodshed as possible. Remember this, Corrin. If you are ever faced with the enemy, know that many of their officers are under spells, and their will is not their own. They are slaves to Mertis. You should not hate them. You should pity them. The human soldiers of Isidore have their minds poisoned against us since the day they are born. They know only hatred, cruelty, and fear. And the orcs, well, they needed no magical spells to join forces with Mertis.
This Mertis is Greylock. And he's real?
Corrin had always thought it was only a story, that there was no real Draelock.
Not the same Lord Draelock. He can't be, can he? Didn't all this happen a very long time ago?
The wizard looked out the window for a long time, lost in thought. When he spoke, his voice was low, and sounded as if he were far away.
The same. Mertis seized power in Isidore,
almost 1,700 years ago now. And he is still alive, his body a mere husk by now, his life sustained through the power of dark magic, draining the life from young slaves, killing them to keep himself attached to this world by a thin cord. By now there is nothing left of Mertis the Man, for one of the great dangers of using dark magic is that the demons of the spirit world cannot be controlled for long. When Mertis chose to use dark magic, without knowing the risks, he himself became slave to a demon of the underworld. He cracked open a sliver of a gate through which demons are trying to enter our world. That is why I fight against. If Tarador is defeated, the demons will grow so strong they will tear asunder the borders between the spirit world and our world, and our world will descend into darkness forever.
The next day, Corin went to the stables to feed, exercise, and brush Thunderbolt. For much of the morning he walked around in a daze, for he had slept hardly at all, his mind filled with thoughts of evil wizardry and demons. As he filled Thunderbolt's feed bucket from the oats bin, he asked the stable master, "Sir, do you think horses get tired of eating the same food every day?"
"Huh?"
the man asked, looking up from his account books.
"They're horses. Why, is Thunderbolt off his feed?"
The stable master did not want to hear of any problems with Corin's horse. That devil beast had made his life difficult every day from its birth until Corin came to the stables.
"No, no, he eats fine, sir. He likes it when I bring him carrots and apples, but he mostly eats these oats and hay. It's not very tasty."
"Tasty? What? Corin, what's this about?"
The stable master put aside the account book and rose from the cubbyhole he used as an office.
"It's nothing. Pedrus just said last night that he is tired of eating bland food. He meant our food, here, in Tarador."
"Oh, is that all?"
The stable master cuffed Corin on the shoulder.
"You should talk to Martell. You know Martell?"
"Yes. Why Martell?"
Martell was a friendly stable hand, a man with glossy dark hair and a full moustache he seemed to be proud of. The stable master shrugged.
"Martell is from Mestada, like Pedrus."
Corin blinked.
"I thought he was from Stayd."
He pronounced the word Stayd in the Tarradoran accent.
"Ha ha!"
the stable master chuckled.
"Stayd is what we in Tarador call Martell's homeland. They call it Estada."
Corin found Martell unloading bales of hay from a wagon and pitched in to help.
"Martell, you're from Estada, right? Pedrus told me last night that he misses the food from your land."
Martell grunted.
"The food here is what we feed to babies in Estada. It has no flavor. My wife, she came here with me. She can cook real food. You should come to dinner at my house. I will show you what good food tastes like."
The dreary winter dragged on, and nothing much of importance happened around the castle. Corin was pleased to see that, compared to winters in Krebs Ford, the season in Tarador's capital city was milder. Milder did not mean it was warm. In fact, having more rain than snow seemed to make the air even more damp, and the cold seeped into Corin's clothes worse than any cold he'd known in snowy Winterthur province. The cold dampness saturated the grey stones of the wizard's tower. Corin had to keep fires roaring in the stoves on both the floors of both the wizard's living and sleeping quarters, and the laboratory, where he spent most of his time. The floor where Corin slept had no nice iron stove.
just a small fireplace that seemed to let most of the heat go up the chimney. His little room was just warm enough in the evenings, but by the time he woke up in the mornings, he hated to crawl out from under the heavy pile of blankets of his bed. Fortunately, as a boy growing up in Winterthur, he had learned a few tricks to deal with cold mornings. When he went to bed, he rolled up clothes for the morning and tucked them in next to him, so they would be warm when he put them on. And he had a small iron sort of basket that would hold hot coals overnight. Usually, there were one or two coals still glowing a dull orange in the morning, which he could use to get a fire started. His routine was to get dressed while still under the blankets, then wrap himself in a blanket and scurry across the floor to get a fire started. Once flames were flickering in the fireplace, he ducked back in bed for a quarter of an hour, while the fire raised the temperature of the room to a tolerable level. After that, he went up the stairs to stoke the fires in the stoves for the wizard, put water on for coffee, and went across the courtyard to fetch breakfast from the royal kitchens. The cooks there always had a covered tray ready for the wizard, while Corin could usually count on a bowl of porridge and maybe a buttered roll. Sometimes there was also an egg or a piece of fruit for Corin, and he was always sure to thank the cooks for that. It still seemed like a bit of a miracle to Corin how he got food at the castle. To get milk, he did not need to lead a cow into a barn and get a pitcher, which he had first scrubbed clean and rinsed with boiling water, and sit next to the cow, milking it. Instead, the royal kitchens had milk in cooled ceramic jugs. For butter, he did not have to skim the cream off the top of a pitcher, and spend what seemed like forever plunging a churn up and down to make butter. Here, it was ready in earthen crocks. Even his simple morning porridge was not oats he had gathered from the field during harvest season. The oats here were in big wooden bins. He didn't even have to start a fire and cook the porridge by himself. The royal cooks did that for him. All he needed to do was bring a bowl for the cooks to ladle fresh, steaming hot porridge into. And then they spooned fresh cream on top, and a couple cubes of maple sugar. Corin thought he was in heaven his first week living in the castle. Winter evenings, when he lay in bed after putting out the candle, watching the fire slowly dying down to embers, and feeling the cold creeping in, Corin considered how lucky he was to be inside, safe from the nasty weather, with a bed and warm clothes and blankets, and a fireplace, and hot food waiting for him in the morning. He would not, he had realized after the second snowfall, have survived the winter on his own in the wilderness. The few supplies his parents had left him with were not enough for him to have made warm clothes and construct a shelter, and a sure enough food to last until springtime. As miserable as winter was in Linden, it was colder in the north, and without the royal carriage to whisk him from Lavan, he would not have been able to walk much further south, not on his own, and with having to stop along the way to hunt, fish, and forage for food. That thought had caused Corin to cry himself to sleep one particularly grey, cold, and dreary night. When his parents had abandoned him, Corin had foolishly thought at first they had been careful to leave him with the means to survive on his own. Now he knew they had not cared whether he lived or died, only that they were well rid of him, forever. That was a hard thing for a boy to realize, alone on a cold, dark night. As the winter wore on, Corin and Arianna continued to search the ancient scrolls for hints of where they might find the cornerstone. Some days, Corin genuinely was eager to tackle the puzzle of what had happened to the cornerstone. Most days, however, what he cared about was being in the royal palace, where he had a break from his duties, and where it was always warm and well lit by lamps and large windows, and there was always plenty of delicious food at Ariana's table. And there was also an opportunity to spend time with Ariana, with her smile and her perfumed hair, and the way she tilted her head, and her voice that was music to Corin's ear, and the way she delicately bit her thumbnail when she was reading, and the way the curly locks of her hair kept falling forward around her face, and she would either toss her head or brush the hair out of her face, tucking it behind her ear, and Corin needed to concentrate on reading. Reading the dusty old scrolls so far had done nothing but make Corin sneeze, until Ariana found a scroll about plans for expanding the castle, hundreds of years before the battle when the cornerstone was lost. The plan showed there was a wide vault that ran almost underneath the cornerstone's chamber. The vault had originally carried water, but the plan showed the vault had been blocked at both ends and abandoned. "Maybe," Ariana had said excitedly. "The enemy had cut a hole in the floor, lowered the cornerstone into the vault, and then replaced the floor." When the princess and the servant boy found time to search for the cornerstone, they looked for a way into the old vault. Mostly, Corin searched on his own, when he wasn't running errands for the wizard. When Ariana was able to join him, she had to bring along her personal guard, a gentle, older man named Dustin, who had retired from being a soldier. Dustin's job was to keep Ariana and her dignity as a princess out of trouble, including avoiding scandals such as her sneaking around the castle with a handsome young boy. Dustin had a daughter of his own, older than Ariana, and although he took orders from Carlana, he felt the young princess needed freedom to be a girl. So, unless she was actually in danger, Dustin pretty much let Ariana do what she wanted, under his supervision. After 2 months of exploring the back walls of storerooms and crawling in tight spaces between walls, Corin found what he thought must be a way into the old vault. At the end of a narrow crawl space, there was an iron gate, with a lock corroded with centuries of rust. Corin met Ariana and Dustin there one cold winter evening, after the princess had supposedly gone to sleep. Corin pulled tools out of a leather bag. "The lock is rusted shut, but one of the hinges is broken. I brought a hammer and chisel to knock the other hinge open." Ariana picked up the hammer and looked at the gate. "Won't that make a lot of noise?" She gave the hammer to Corin. "Yup, but the guard above us is wearing iron-soled shoes." Corin pointed at the low ceiling and put a finger to his lips. Ariana could hear, faintly through the rock, the clicking of a heavy man's shoes on the stone floor. They counted. The guard took 18 steps in one direction, turned, and took 18 steps back. "You go back outside and warn us if the guard stops."
"Us?" Dustin asked skeptically.
Corin said uncertainly.
"I can't hold this gate by myself."
"Please, Dustin," Ariana pleaded in the little girl voice that she had been using to manipulate men since she was barely able to walk. "It won't hurt anything. Besides, I'm the Crown Princess. This gate belongs to me, doesn't it?"
Dustin scratched his short grey beard while he thought, "Your mother, the regent, may disagree with you there, young missy."
He winked and smiled.
"But she's never going to know, is she?"
"Okay,"
Ariana said with a grin, and walked back down to the entrance, which was behind stacked crates in a dusty storeroom. She counted 16, 17, 18, turn and 1, 2. Corin tapped the chisel with the hammer, knocking the hinge pin upward slightly. He tried to tap in rhythm with the faint sounds of the boots above. 17, 18,
Corin, stop, Ariana whispered. Almost there.
The guard resumed his patrol, and Corin resumed tapping with the hammer, in time with the footfalls.
Almost there, Dustin. Hold the gate up a bit.
Ugh, it's heavy for my old bones. Hurry it up if you can.
Just as the pin came out, and the gate sagged against the wall with a clanging sound, Ariana called out a warning.
The guard stopped walking.
Corin sat still, his heart pounding. If they were caught, he could be in serious trouble. As the Crown Princess, all Ariana had to worry about was the scolding from her mother. Corin might be banished from the castle. He sighed with relief when he heard the guard above resume patrolling.
Come on,
Corin called out, squeezing around the broken gate and sliding down into the old vault. The Crown Princess was right behind him.
Yuck,
Ariana said in disgust, lifting her shoe off the floor.
Tchuh,
Dustin exhaled in dismay.
I'll need to be cleaning those shoes before morning, lest your mother notice you weren't snug on your bed all night.
The floor is wet. Must be water still seeping in from below. Be careful.
Corin led the way, holding his torch out in front of him. The flickering flames cast eerie shadows on the curved walls of the old vault.
How much further?
Ariana asked, trying to step around the slimiest of the puddles. She would ask Norelka to clean the shoes. Corin looked up.
We should be right under the hallway that leads to the cornerstone chamber. But I don't see any signs that someone cut a hole in the roof.
Look, the stones fit so close together, there isn't any mortar between the blocks. He held the torch near the floor and scraped slime away with his foot.
And there aren't any marks like there should be if a heavy object was dragged down here.
Now that they were in the vault, he could see it was barely wide enough to hold the cornerstone. It had looked so much larger on the old scrolls.
Let's keep going,
Ariana suggested. The other end can't be far. The floor of the vault sloped downward, and the puddles grew deeper as they walked further into the vault. Corin had to brush spiderwebs away with his torch. Finally, they came to the end of the vault, a solid stone wall.
If the cornerstone had ever been there, it wasn't there now.
Ariana could sense Corin's disappointment.
Maybe it's behind this wall.
There's something carved into the stones here, Corin said. He wiped the grime away from the stone with a rag.
Oh! What is it?
Corin snorted in disgust.
It says Nestor was here. The cornerstone is not. May you who read this inscription have better fortune.
And there's a date, but I can't read it.
Nestor was the second Trahane king of Tarador, Ariana exclaimed.
She reached out and traced the carving with her fingers.
My ancestor wrote this with his own hand.
We're not the first to search this vault for the cornerstone.
No, Ariana laughed. Did you think we would really find the cornerstone?
Deep in his heart, Corin thought they would find the cornerstone, that somehow it was his fate to find it. In fact, he had been certain he would find it.
Yes, I guess so.
You didn't?
Then why search for it?
Ariana shrugged. It's more fun than doing needlepoint. She stuck out her tongue playfully.
Don't be discouraged, young man. You got a lot further than I did, back when I was your age, and searching for the cornerstone myself.
Dustin held his torch close to the inscription and traced Nestor's name with his finger in awe. Corin shook his head. Finding Nestor's mocking inscription had taken all the fun out of searching for the cornerstone.
Let's go. It's cold down here, he grumbled.
It was not until a week later that Ariana had another opportunity to invite Corin to lunch in her library. The table was laden with delicious treats, but Corin saw that Ariana had books and scrolls piled on top of a desk. How about this one? Ariana suggested. It's a record of how the original castle was expanded. This isn't about that stupid cornerstone again, is it? I thought you liked looking for the cornerstone.
I did, when I thought we had a real chance to find it.
If King Nestor, with all his troops and advisers, couldn't find it, what chance do we have?
Ariana bit her lower lip and looked down to blink away a tear. She had so wanted to have a nice afternoon with Corin. The day was sunny and warm enough for the windows to be cracked open. The light breeze brought in scents that held the promise of springtime. Ariana had gone down to the royal kitchens herself to make sure her table was set with Corin's favorite honey cakes, but it hardly touched the food.
Corin, what's wrong?
Nothing, Corin said, feeling a little guilty. He saw the honey cakes and knew Ariana had gone to extra trouble to make him happy.
I'm tired as all. This morning Thunderbolt was cranky and wanted to go for a long ride, and I didn't have time because Pedrus almost blew up his laboratory yesterday, and I had to straighten up.
Ariana had heard the explosion and seen the yellow smoke rising from the highest chamber of the wizard's tower.
What was he doing?
Corin managed a smile.
I never ask. It's better not to.
Can I see that scroll?
The two sat quietly for a while, reading scrolls. Or rather, Corin was engrossed in reading a scroll about the early days of the Wizard's Council, and Ariana was watching Corin. Whenever he looked up, she glanced away, pretending she was looking at a scroll, or a map, or nibbling on a honey cake. But she was looking at Corin. The way his thick curls of hair fell in front of his eyes, the curve of his jaw, the way his eyelids slowly blinked while he was reading. Her hero, the boy who had saved her from a bear, a raging river, and a pack of bandits, all by himself. And she couldn't even tell people how very brave he was, for that would draw the enemy's attention to him. Ariana had heard about girls getting foolish crushes on boys from listening to her maids. Those silly girls fell in love with a different boy every week. Ariana was sure what she felt for Corin was different. Of course it was. The boy she had a crush on was a true hero. But other girls probably thought their own crushes were true love also. And true love was a romantic notion that a crown princess, and certainly not a queen, could not spend much time dreaming about. Queens married for political advantage, not for love. She sighed, loud enough for Corin to hear.
Huh?
Corin asked. Did you say something?
No.
Corin, do you ever think about getting married someday?
Married?
A boy who was not tired and not intent on stuffing himself with honey cakes and reading about wizards would have recognized the dreamy look on the crown princess's face. But Corin was very tired and getting very stuffed with honey cakes.
No, I never thought about it.
Not really.
Why did girls always want to talk about such things?
How about you?
The dreamy look fell from Ariana's face.
Mother says I'll marry the son of a duke, whoever offers the best alliance within Tarador.
Or maybe a prince from another kingdom. I'm sure Mother will find someone suitable, someone horribly boring. She made a face.
But when you're queen, you could marry anyone you like, Corin said with surprise.
What good was being a queen if you couldn't do whatever you wanted?
It's not like that. I have to think about what's best for Tarador, not only about what I want.
I think that stinks. If I were king, I would marry any girl I liked.
What kind of girl do you like?
Ariana asked, while twirling a strand of hair around her finger.
Oh, I don't know. That's all too far away to think about now. It doesn't matter anyway. I'm living in a cubbyhole of the Wizard's Tower. That doesn't make me a good catch for girls.
Some girls would think you're a good catch, Arianna said in a small voice. She hadn't thought about the subject of marriage from Corin's side. He was living in the royal castle, but in truth, he was only a penniless servant.
Corin shrugged. Maybe someday I can rent land for a farm somewhere. My father bought his own land before he met my mother. My mother says he was the best catch in the whole village.
You like farming? Arianna asked, surprised.
It didn't sound like fun to her. I know how to do it. You need a skill if you're not going to be someone's servant your whole life. I mean, not you. You're a princess, and you'll be queen. You'll never have to worry about earning your keep.
The conversation was not going where Arianna wanted.
Would you like another honey cake?
That evening, Corin was walking across the castle courtyard with Cully,
after helping the other servant boy move furniture from a part of the castle that was going to be renovated. It was hard work, and the tired boys were headed to the kitchens to scrounge up whatever food was available.
Look, it's the princess, Cully whispered as he grabbed Corin's arm.
Arianna was standing on a stone platform up against the castle wall, bundled up in fine, heavy clothes, her hair waving gently in the cold breeze.
She's reviewing the evening changing of the guard, Cully explained.
I want to see, Corin said, standing on his toes to see above the crowd. Let's go around the side.
They squeezed their way along the wall until they were in front, close to Arianna's personal guards. A guard held out a hand to prevent them getting closer, then recognized Corin and nodded. The boys stood quietly, waiting for the princess to signal the ceremony to begin. Arianna looked around the assembled crowd, from left to right, and when she saw Corin, she smiled and winked at him, then gestured the guards to begin.
Cully at first thought the princess had smiled and winked at him, which froze him in place for a second.
When he realized Corin had been the target of her affections, he looked at the other boy and frowned. They stood silently until the guard had been changed, and the princess escorted back inside the castle.
Brother, you are in trouble,
Cully said in a low voice, shaking his head.
Huh? What do you mean?
I saw you making goo-goo eyes at the princess. What in the world are you thinking? Not thinking, you must be.
I was not making goo-goo eyes at Harry, at the princess.
You should have seen your face. You were all, oh, I'm so in love with her. The princess is my everything,
Cully said mockingly.
Was not,
Corin said hotly, his face red from embarrassment.
Was too. I know what I saw. Seriously. You must be crazy in the head or something. She's the crown princess. She's gonna be queen soon. Her mother could have your head chopped off if she saw you looking at the princess that way. Listen, brother, I know you're more used to being around goats than royalty, but there, up here...
Cully stretched his hand up way high over his head.
And we're down there someplace.
He pointed at the muddy ground.
You can't even... think about what you're thinking. You know that, right? She's gonna marry some duke's son, or a prince from a foreign land. And you may not always be a servant, but you will always be common born.
Corin looked down at the ground miserably.
I know all that. You don't need to tell me, I know who I am.
A lowly servant. A boy without a family.
I'm grateful to be where I am, with a roof over my head and food in my belly. I don't ask for more than that. Speaking of food in my belly, let's get to the kitchens before all these guards going off duty eat everything.
Seeing Nestor's inscription had dampened Corin's enthusiasm for finding the cornerstone, but reading the musty old scrolls in Arianna's library renewed his interest. If the weather had been warmer, he might have put it aside, but as it was still winter, and there wasn't much else to do, the itch to find the cornerstone came back quickly. As the winter snows began to melt, and patches of stubbly grass appeared in the muddy fields around the castle, Corin returned to studying ancient scrolls for clues about where the corner